You know, like inherited wealth, are there benefits and are there harms in inherited wealth? That's what we want to know. We want to measure to evaluate there are certain benefits and certain harms. We want to evaluate the benefits and the harms of inherited wealth. The question is, are you also raised in wisdom? In other words, the question is, it seems to be, it's not whether wealth or non-wealth is the issue, but the question is the way you're raised. Is that what you're saying? In other words, what you're saying is, wealth with wisdom could be a wonderful thing. It could be a benefit in life.
Right.
Because then you could have a good life and you could have the time for carrying out the life of wisdom. But if it's without wisdom, then it could be a catastrophe, because then the wealth would... So what you're really saying has nothing to do with the wealth, it has to do with the way you're raised. If you're raised with wisdom, doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you'll work out your life correctly.
Right.
And if you're not raised with wisdom, then the result would be that you probably, in other words, whether you're going to have a good life or not is a matter of chance. It's not dependent on your decisions, but it's dependent on chance in your life. Okay. The question is, many leaders. If you have a government, you have many leaders. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, again, pros and cons of many leaders. The first possibility we want to say is that it's a good thing, because then you have the view of many people. Then you have the view of many people, so you could come up with the best view of all the people. The problem with that thing is that most people cannot come to good the same result. In other words, and therefore you're going to have different decisions. In other words, when you have two people having it's worse to have two different decisions than one bad decision. Where united is better than where disunity. You see? So the thing is that in that way many leaders would be a bad thing. Because if they could all make the decision, they could come to different opinions, and therefore be that would be a real problem. Well, you are right that you need the opinions of others, but those should be advisors.
Right.
In other words, you should have advisors, but there's one person making a decision. By the way, this would apply also to a marriage. Children are usually confused if there's arguments. There's no arguments. Even if it's a wrong thing, it's not good, but it's worse where it's confusing and they don't know which way to go. They have to make a decision which leader to follow. That becomes a difficult thing. In other words, let's say, for instance, a person is raised in the home of a Nazi. They both agree. Okay, now that is evil, and that's going to lead to destruction. Okay, that happens to be true. But insofar as the person that is following, insofar as his ability, in other words, to have some type of cohesiveness in himself, or in other words, it would be terrible confusing. It would be hard for him to make decisions. It would cause him, he'd definitely be in conflict. Besides the conflict, it comes out that it can be difficult to make decisions raised in such situations. In other words, because if there's two different conflicts, you have two different messages that you have to deal with at an age that you're too young to deal with different messages. In a nation, definitely, there would be people joining one side, people joining the other side, like the country becomes divided. You understand, like in a democracy, like now, we have people divided by, like let's say, abortion or right to choose. So the thing is that the country is divided. the whole country. There's not one, you understand, has to be clarified. I think that's a bad thing. The question is what about in like a nation where you have two different options? Okay, the question is what are the options? Okay, there is a certain basic foundation that if you have, then you can have options after the basic foundation. If you don't have the basic foundation, then the options is basic to your life. In other words, like let's say, for instance, in Judaism, we have many different arguments. We have arguments whether what the definition of a knot is that you're not allowed to make on Shabbos, right? Well, but it's not the basic thing of whether there is a God or not a God, or whether we should obey Torah or not obey Torah. That's two different lifestyles. So it depends when you talk about options, where you're giving the options. To start with, the person cannot start with basic premises. And if the differences in basic premises, what the child looks at basic premises, or as a nation, that it's a basic premise to their very existence, like in other words, like abortion and not abortion. I mean, these people hold that it's a religious conviction. It's based on their that hold that the anti-abortion is it's a religious thing, and there's no you cannot do it. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, halachically, I can't have an abortion, right? But I can understand the nation who is not Jewish; they could have abortions. It would not be against my religion. To deny them their rights in this area. Murder is a different thing. You understand? But that's plain justice. But the thing is that depends how you look at the thing that you're arguing. It's a basic foundation, then you're going to divide the nation, or if in the mind of the child, it's very basic. The basic thing in their life, you understand, to them it's the basis. To you it might be a nothing. If to them it's the basis, they hear a conflict in that, then they're caught. You see? The example given in the former Soviet Union, there were many parents that recognized that the government was evil. I mean, from the wise people, they recognized it. But however, they didn't give this information over to their children because the children would be in terrible conflict, and besides which they'd have to keep a secret, which is very difficult, you see. But they definitely would be in conflict between what they're being taught at the school and what they'd be taught at home. But later on, they could be given the truth, and then when they're old enough to handle it and they're wise enough to handle it, then you do it. Then you educate them. In certain philosophies also, I mean, like, for instance, we don't say you should teach everybody philosophy. You have to teach them halacha. Everybody's taught halacha. But who's taught the philosophy? I mean, that's individuals who have the ability to understand the basic premises and have the ability to analyze the basic premises. But if you give it to them at too young an age, then they become, can't make decisions. I've known people that got into philosophy too early and they closed their mind. They refused to even look at it afterwards because it was too early. They didn't know how to handle the basic premises, how to deal with the basic premises. In other words, even the public, I mean, talk to a right-wing Christian, you understand, and tell them that abortion, there's no definite, the word murder is not a scientific term, it's a legal term. And therefore, since we live in America, we should vote on it. Should be done according to the rules, the way laws are made in America. They cannot even think of that possibility. They cannot even deal with it. So how you deal with them has to be on a different way. Some people you can't straighten out. You see? It still bothers me the question. Whether it's better to have conflict or to be raised in a totally evil like a Nazis, like a Nazis family would have conflict. That I am not sure. When I think about it, I just don't know, because evil raised in evil is a catastrophic type of life altogether. You see? That's a good question. And one observation is that the conflict will come, because the evil must lead to conflict. So you must have conflict there, but you will not have it right away. You will have conflict in your life. This evil leads to conflict. Question is, insofar as conflict is concerned, which would be worse? At least the person that's raised in the house of different possibilities, then at least he could see the different possibilities he could get out of it. Maybe in the house of evil, might be better to be raised with two different views. Because then at least you could have the possibility of getting out, because you see other possibilities, so there's the possibility of getting out of the evil. But I really, I don't know, 100% I'm not sure.
Rabbi?
Hey, the question is by the Tower of Babel, where the people were all one idea, they turned against God, and God divided into different nations, okay? So the thing is, evil, definitely philosophically, evil is definitely, I would say that's a good point. That evil definitely leads to consequences. Okay? Evil was probably worse than conflict. Because conflict, I think you're right. Because conflict, at least you could see the other possibilities. In conflict, you're open to other possibilities, but if it's totally one way, then there's no conflict, then you'll definitely be, in other words, you might not have conflict in the when you're being raised, but however, you will have conflict in carrying out your life, because evil must have consequences. So therefore, if it's a totally evil society, then it's better to have different views. It's a just society, then it's better to have one view. Let's put it this way: the basics should be one view, but in details you could have different. You could teach them different views at a certain age. It depends. Too young, you also can't do that. Certain age, like in halacha, you have in halacha different views, and we could tolerate the different views. So your mind is open to different views. You see. So once it's open to different views, it gives you a chance to think of other possibilities. Okay? All right. We want to just summarize to see what we have here. In other words, it seems to be that if you have a society or a family with a certain mission which is not evil, then it's better to have one leader. We could have many advisors, and many advisors is good, but you should just have one leader. But if it's a society of evil, then it's better to have different views so that there is a chance for the people that are part of this group to be able to pull out of once they see the other possibility, then they're able to pull out. I think that's the best way of explaining it. All right, the question is like this: what is the harm to the person when he oppresses others? Okay? When you oppress others, what is the harm to the person that does the oppression? What is the harm to him? What was said so far is that oppression, in other words, since it is unjust, you're saying that in other words, since you're doing something that's not in line with reality, okay? So therefore, you're going to make decisions that are not in line with reality, and then you will develop to make more and more decisions out of reality until you destroy yourself. Okay, that's true. The question is, what is there about oppression in particular, which is either out of reality or that it will harm you? Okay, that is the question. In other words, what you're doing is you're making a general statement which happens to be true. Okay? And that is the approach that we have to have here. So what we want to know is oppression in general. What is the harm in that? In what way are you going to get out of reality with oppression? So we want to say that the quality is over here that there's a feeling, there's like two sides of the same coin. There's a feeling that I am superior than these people, or that these, in other words, sometimes you think in terms of yourself, or sometimes you think that these people are of no value, that you have the right to destroy them because they are of no value. In other words, you're making the decision of who has value in a society. You're saying there are certain people that have value, certain people that don't have value, and the people that have value have the right to harm and to destroy others. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in what way, in other words, when you have this trait, okay, the question is, in what way will you, in other words, in what way, how are you going to start making decisions, or how are you going to start thinking that you will destroy yourself, that you will be destroyed, that you will be harmed? In other words, every trait makes you look at things differently. Now, this trait is going to, in other words, superficially, it looks like, on the contrary, if we're more powerful, we are stronger than you, then we should be able to control it. You understand? And we should be more successful, because we are the better people. Let's say they really are in strength, or in wisdom, whatever. They make decisions that way. You see? They look down on others, you see? And they think they're special, and therefore they're going to act on that, that they're above others, or others are of no value. I'm not sure if that's two different things, or they come simultaneously together. You see that? In other words, when you think that you're above them, then you act to people as if they have no value. You see? Now, if that is true, then how are you going to think differently when you start carrying this thing out? How is it going to affect the way you think? All right. So we want to say that because of this trait, that you will, that in certain situations, instead of analyzing the situation correctly, you will assume that you will be successful based on this superiority. Since I'm superior, by definition, I will be successful, and I won't analyze the particulars and to see where they might be successful, and I will overlook details that I'll take for granted because I'm superior than them. So therefore, I will try to destroy them in that way. So therefore, when I try to destroy them without thinking out the details, that's one way that that you can fail. Okay? There's also one other way, and that is in general, but this is more general, that if you don't operate by wisdom, then you operate according to a certain pattern. Right? Once you know the pattern, any pattern could be, like for instance, the blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg is a good attack if the people are not aware that it's happening. But once you see that every time he has an attack, he opens the front, he does it with a blitzkrieg, there are ways of breaking it down. You see? So the thing is that when you have a certain personality and you don't change according to the situation at hand, but you act based on your patterns, then that will give the enemy, after time, not right away, but after time, they will be able to recognize these patterns, and then you could always have a counteroffensive against a certain pattern. Once you know the pattern in beforehand, then you could always tell, then you could have a plan what to do. In other words, like the United States, they know how to win a war. We have the power to win the war. But however, what to do with the country after we win the war, that we don't know what to do. And we didn't think what was happening to Israel could happen to us. But that's exactly what's happening in Iraq. Now, we're in Iraq, and the people don't care if they die. You understand? They go straight to heaven. And they're killing off soldiers. You know what I mean? Very slowly, but surely, they're putting us in a position, very defensive position, and they don't care if they die, and the United States does. And so, therefore, they're going to wear us down, because we don't know what to do with that type of situation. So the suggestion was offered, why don't we leave? Yeah, but once we leave, then there will be another evil. Let's say Saddam is dead. And another, who's going to take over? The one that's most evil, the most powerful, is going to come and he's going to take over. So we have the same problem all over again. So we never learned how to deal with the problem. That wasn't worked out.
Very good point.
In other words, our president is a good wartime general, but he doesn't know the nature of peace, how to bring peace, how to deal with the country that has a different way of looking at life. That you also have to consideration. You look at life as peace, you know, we want peace, democracy. But they don't look at it that way.
Right.
So therefore, how do you deal with it afterwards? That there has to be a plan. That plan was never there. They had a plan for war, but not for peace. Or how to deal with it afterwards. All right, we're doing Proverbs chapter 28, verse 4. And it says, those that leave the Torah praise the wicked, and the guardians of Torah argue with them. Those that leave the Torah praise the wicked, and the guardians of the Torah argue with them. All right, the question is why would they bother, why would the guardians of the Torah bother arguing with the ones that leave the Torah? And also, why don't they argue directly with the wicked? You understand, why don't they argue with the wicked? If they're arguing, why don't the Pasuk say the wicked and they argue with the wicked? And the question is, why should, that's the first question. The first question is, why should they argue with anybody? If they left the Torah or they're wicked, why should they argue with them? Second question is on the verse itself, why does it say they argue with those that leave the Torah? Why does it say they argue with the wicked? The question is if the people left Torah, it says they praise the wicked. Why does it say they praise the wicked? I mean, they left Torah. Why did it just say they left the Torah? That's it. What does it have to do with praising the wicked? The Rabbak says that that there are two reasons why the people leave Torah. One is they see something wrong in Torah. Two is that they have a different philosophy. You understand? And because of the different philosophy, so they don't accept Torah. Okay? So praising the wicked means that they show how the life, either they show why the Torah is wrong, that is in fact praising the wicked, that's in line with the wicked, or they show, or they have a philosophy why a certain lifestyle, which is against Torah, is a better lifestyle. You see? And therefore, the guardians of the Torah argue with them on these arguments. Either they argue with them on a defense of the Torah, they argue about a defense of Torah, if it's an attack on Torah, or if the people have a certain philosophy, then they'll show the contradictions in that philosophy. Okay? Now, the Hebrew for a guardian of the Torah, it says Shomrei Torah. Shomrei Torah is sometimes translated as those that keep the Torah, and Shomer could be a guardian of Torah. Now, insofar as a person is a halachic person, so he keeps the Torah, but he might not know the arguments why he should keep the Torah. He only knows that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, and therefore he's obligated to keep it, but he doesn't really see the benefit in Torah. On the contrary, he might even see that the other lifestyle is the best. He might even have the philosophy of the people that left Torah. But however, they say, but I have to keep Torah because there's a God. You see? That's a keeper of Torah. That was the person that keeps Torah. But a guardian of Torah, that's where Mishlei comes in, where the subject of Mishlei comes in. A chacham, a wise person, must know why he is keeping a certain way of life and not another. So he would have the arguments of why he should not keep the other way of life and why he should keep this way of life. So therefore, this interpretation of Shomrei Torah, the guardian of Torah, is only in Mishlei, where we're involved in Chachma, and therefore he should have the answers. The nature is of the person, he should have the answers to answer anybody that wants to leave Torah and has arguments why they don't want to keep Torah. So you should have all the arguments why you should keep Torah, you see. But however, if there are people that are just keep Torah, but they're not into the world of Mishlei, and they're not Chachamim, and they just keep Torah because God gave Torah on Mount Sinai, which is a good thing, but it is a lower level. Okay? The question is that why should you bother arguing with somebody that went in a different approach? Is there any benefit? I mean, especially if you can't win them over. The answer is that many times the argument is not to win them over, but to make sure others don't learn from them. In other words, there's a certain type, forget about others learning from them, but there's a certain level where we must understand why we keep Torah. In other words, there's one level, I keep Torah because God said. That's it. And I might be jealous of other people that have things that I think is great, but I don't go towards those things because I obey God. You see? While the Shomrei Torah, the Chacham, is a person that understands that God commanded the Torah, but he also understands what the benefit of Torah is and what's the harm of all the other philosophies. He accepts Torah and relates to Torah on a different level than just accepting God. You see? He accepts it because he sees God's wisdom and that God gave the Torah because that is the best possible life that a human being could live. So therefore, he must have the arguments either for himself or for others that have not left Torah or for people that want to leave Torah because they have these arguments. So these are the people that he wants to argue with. But originally, he has these arguments only because he himself has them, because he himself has the must have worked out the ideas. That is the Chacham. He sees the benefit of Torah. That is the Chacham. That's a further development. In other words, when you first start out, you obey God and you keep the Torah because God said so. Then there's a further development where you learn Mishlei and you become a Chacham. Part of being a Chacham is to know why I keep Torah and why I don't keep any, and why all the other philosophies are incorrect. The question is what about, there are certain people that are lamdanim. A lamdan is a person well-versed in halacha. Okay? The answer is that there are people that are well-versed in halacha. They could give classes and give abstract classes, but they might not know musar. They might not know the benefit and the argument of why they should keep Torah. They only keep Torah because God said you should keep the Torah. So therefore they obey God and they keep halacha correctly. But however, there's a further development in understanding and to be able to argue what is the benefit of Torah and what is the harm of all other views of life that are contradictory to Torah. We're still in chapter 28, the verse 5, and it says, evil people don't understand justice, and the searchers of God, those that search for God, understand everything. And we said that's a big jump from justice to understand everything. What is the connection between justice and understanding everything? Okay. The question is, in the last verse, we said there are people that left Torah, meaning if they left Torah, meaning they understood, they might have understood justice, right? And now we're saying that evil people don't understand justice. How could it say they don't understand justice? I mean, there are people that might have understood justice at one time, and then they decided to leave the life of justice and live the life of injustice, right? But however, the thing is, but if you ask them questions about justice, they understand it. They could explain it. They understood it at one time. It's not that they forgot it. So there's the question, what does it mean they don't understand justice? Not all evil people don't understand justice. The Rabban explains that the evil people, when it says, and Rashi is very clear, that when they don't understand justice, is they don't recognize the consequences of their actions. In other words, again, if you go to halacha, so I keep halacha or I keep the Torah because God said so. If you're a chacham, you recognize the consequences of keeping halacha. These people do not recognize the consequences of the, in other words, even if they ever understood the consequences, it is not real to them. They're closing it off. In other words, how do I know they're closing it off? Because they're not living by it. It means it's not real to them. Okay? So therefore, you could have knowledge which is not real to you. You could quote things, but you don't live by it. You see? So therefore, the anchera, the evil people, it means they don't understand justice. They don't recognize the consequences of their lifestyle. You see? So the Rabbah says the other side is those that are searching for God, okay? In other words, they don't have any emotion counteracting their thinking process. They don't have their desires counteracting. They could be totally objective. And since they're totally objective, they could understand all the consequences and harm that could be, and it could be very clear to them, that lifestyle, because they don't let their emotions affect their thinking process. They might have the emotions, but they're able to think clearly. Those people that are searching for God are able to think clearly. That's what it means, they understand everything. It doesn't mean, when we first learned the pasuk, we thought it meant all different types of subjects they understand. Well, not everybody that searches for God understands physics and math, science. I mean, they might not understand everything. But however, the thing is, what it means they understand everything is there's nothing that hinders them in their ability to think. And so therefore, when they're able to get involved in the world of thought, they're able to see every act and the consequences, even though it runs contrary to their emotions. But the evil people only want to live according to their emotions. Their emotions block off any type of thought about consequences or any thought that affects their desires. So therefore, they don't understand justice. That's what it means. If they don't understand justice, meaning they don't see the reality of it, you don't see the consequences of not living the life of justice. In other words, there's two ways of relating to justice. One is through understanding, and one is that something prevents you from seeing the ideas of justice. Right? One is you understand justice. One, you could study justice, but however, your emotions prevent you from understanding the ideas of justice. It says, Pasuk Vav, that's verse 6 in chapter 28 says, it's better to be poor and walk in perfection than to have a crooked path and be rich. Now, the first question is that this is quite obvious. Why does he have to tell us this? All right. According to the Mitzvot David, he says it's better to be poor and go in perfection, like in business, because we're talking about a poor person to act correctly than crooked path, and he is wealthy. And we said, yeah, that's very obvious. Okay, the answer is that Mishnah sometimes talks to the emotions. Okay, now you might live the life of halacha, but yet your emotions go the opposite way. So therefore, this pasuk is written for that type of person. We're talking about a person that lives the life of halacha, but his emotions goes the way, like we said before, like he, let's say he's jealous of a person with a stretch limousine, or a person that have houses in three different countries, and you know, like the guy is wealthy, has all this money, and you're jealous of him, but you say, well, I'm still not going to be a crook because I want to keep Torah. But however, he's saying that you should go and know that the life of the poor person who lives a just life is better than a person that is very wealthy and crooked. The poor person has a better life and is better off than the rich person. And that's what you must know. And once you know it, then you won't be in conflict. So according to the Mitzvot David, the pasuk is talking to the emotions of the person that is talking to the emotions of the person that really lives a true life, but he only keeps it because of Torah. And he's telling him, you should study the reasons why your life is the true life, and once you know that, then you will have a good life. In other words, sometimes Mishlei tells you the obvious because it's talking to the emotions, and you must train the emotions with the mind to see that when you keep Torah and the ideas of Torah, that is really the best possible life that a human could live. So in other words, this pasuk and psukim like this, that is talking to a person that lives the halachic life, but he's telling them a very simple fact. He's telling them the fact that they should understand exactly why God commanded the Torah. You should see the benefit for yourself, and you would actually accept being poor and being honest, even though, and you would have no desire, and you wouldn't be jealous of the wicked person at all, because you see that this is the best possible life, and his life is not a good life. Rashi under Al-Bach says it's better to be poor. He says it as a metaphor, not poor in money, but poor in knowledge. He says, Af oni b'Torah, even if you're poor in Torah. But he goes in perfection with the correct actions. The Al-Bach seems to clarify that, and it says it's better if you don't understand ideas, only a few ideas, but he goes with them in perfection and straightforwardness. That is better than a person has crooked ways in his thoughts, and he learns with them a manner, many, many ideas, but they're all crooked, and he acts based on these crooked ideas. In other words, there are people that have unbelievable ideas, and they could quote, they have the tremendous ideas. That person looks like, you know, wow, he's respected by the community. He looks like an intelligent person, you see. That person looks better than a person that just has a few ideas, but each idea is so real to him that he lives based on those small ideas. That is the idea of Rashi, that it's better to be poor in knowledge, but you go in perfection, meaning that you live with those, that's Rashi and Rabbah, that you live with those ideas clearly, justly, straightforward, not crooked, but clear. You keep it 100%. You're better off than a person that has a tremendous amount of knowledge that's covered pages upon pages and able to quote, and people look up to him and people praise him, and he looks like the wise person and you don't, but you're still better off than that person. And the argument is the same thing. Your emotions want to have a lot of knowledge and be accepted by everybody as being the wise and intelligent person. You see? You want to be accepted by as that. But we're saying, no, it's still better to do it on, that you should do it on a little bit and get it 100% clear. That is the better life. And you must see that that is the better life than having a lot of ideas that are not clear. He has many, many ideas, but it says it's crooked. His ways are crooked means he doesn't think clearly. In his decision-making process, he makes stupid decisions. In his personal life, he doesn't live the correct life because it's not real to him, his ideas, and they don't affect him. Or on the contrary, he learns distorted. So then the distorted ideas that he learns help him make more distorted actions because he's studying in a distorted manner. We're on chapter 28, verse 7. And it says, he who guards Torah is the son of an intelligent person. And he who is friendly with partygoers, he destroys his father. I don't know if the word Yahweh means destroys or makes him embarrassed. By parties, it doesn't mean necessarily wild parties. You know, he enjoys life. Goes out to enjoy life. He's a friend. It says he's a friend of partygoers. The question is why does it focus on the parents? Like in the first half, it says the son of a wise person or an intelligent person. And the second half, it says it embarrasses his father. Why doesn't it talk to the person himself? Why does it talk to the parents? My question is that, first of all, why does it say he's friendly with partygoers? Why does he say a partygoer? And two, a person that's friendly with partygoers is like, what's the comparison between a person that keeps Torah? You understand? Like, it seems to be a very big jump from that either you keep Torah or you're a partygoer. You know what I mean? Like, that's so obvious. Like you said, Doug, it's really obvious that one is harmful and one is beneficial. It seems to be a big jump. But anyway, the big question is that why does he say he's a friend of a party goer? What does that mean? Why did you say he's a party goer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to also ask one more question. Why does it say guard Torah? Why didn't it say study Torah? It says guard Torah. It doesn't say study Torah. Funny language. By party goer, it means that their lifestyle is a party. In other words, their lifestyle is partying. In other words, there's nothing wrong in having a party. You can have, the person learns Torah and they can enjoy it, but it's just not their lifestyle.
Right.
Okay? By the term zolalim, the Hebrew word zolalim means it's like a lifestyle to be a party goer.
I'm not sure.
And also, the verse doesn't seem to be analyzing about party goers, because he says he's a friend of a party goer. Which is very strange. You know what I mean? Party goer, that's his lifestyle. He has a party. We're not discussing what is the problem with having a lifestyle of party goers. We seem to be discussing being a friend of party goers. Okay, so the first step we have to take is that we're talking to the parents. That's definitely the word, that he's a son of an intelligent person or he embarrasses his father. Now, if a parent is raising his child to study Torah, so the study of Torah becomes the essence of what the parent wants to get across to the child is the lifestyle of the of the parent, he wants to get across to the child. Now, now the thing is that when you live Torah, there is you start realizing that there's not, that there are things that could pull you away, especially a beginner first starting out in the study of Torah still has his old emotions toward old things, and it could pull him away. So the thing is that if the parent is very careful, he inculcates this into the child, that he protects himself from the from anything that's going to pull him away from the lifestyle of Torah. One of the biggest things which Ruth said was that at a certain age, sometimes friends have a more importance upon you, a more effect on the child than affects the child more than the parent. And therefore, the parent has to be very, very careful of the friends of the child. You see? He has to be very careful. So it's, the pasuk is talking to the parent, saying, you could raise a child to study Torah. But the thing is, since he is a child, which means that he's not totally independent, he's still dependent on you insofar as thinking is concerned and development. He's not a guardian of Torah yet. He doesn't guard to make sure, he himself doesn't guard himself. If he's with people that are party goers, that's their nature, to be party goers, even though there's no harm, they're not evil people, but it can affect the relationship between the student or the child insofar as the studies is concerned, and that is the realm of the parent that has to be careful there. So the pasuk is saying is that the parent could have two types of children. One child already recognizes the problem, he sees the importance of Torah, and he recognizes there's outside influences. So he guards himself that he should not allow outside influences to influence him. Then the parent's responsibility is over. But however, if the child did not reach that stage, then it becomes the parent's responsibility to guard the child and make sure there's no outside influences that could influence the child away from the study of Torah. All right, we're doing verse 8. In chapter 28, and it says, he who adds his wealth through interest, and it uses two terms of interest, there's two types of interest. Okay, one is the you collect money, one is you collect food. All right, but anyway, it is to give, it is, that money is for the person that helps the poor, that gathers for the poor. He's a chonein dalem. Chonein dalem is a person that helps the poor. You see, and he gathers for the poor. Okay? So the verse is saying that if somebody collects money, he makes his living through interest, the money that he gets through the interest will go to a person. Doesn't say it'll go to the poor. It'll go to the person that collects for the poor, who has, you know, who has kindness to the poor and gives to the poor. You see? That is the verse. And, of course, the basic question is, where do you see this? You know what I mean? Like, practically, I mean, where do you see the money goes from? You know what I mean? You don't, where do you see this? That is the basic question. We're talking about a person that he gives money to the poor. We're not talking about business loans, where a wealthy person borrows money or he makes interest on his money. We're talking about a person that became wealthy by lending to the poor, and he collected interest, or if the poor couldn't pay, so he takes away things. He takes from, we're talking about a person that's really not a business person. I understand there are business people that don't have laws against interest, and they, they're not obligated, so they do business through interest. That's fine. I'm not talking about that. The verse seems to be talking about where he harms the poor, and he takes away from the poor, and that's how he becomes wealthy. And it says that he adds. He might even be wealthy, but he adds to his wealth. He constantly builds his wealth by taking advantage of the poor. And because they can't, they need the money, they have no choice, so he constantly destroys them, because they not only have to pay back what they owe, but they also have to pay back the interest. And if they can't, so they take it away. They become, they build their wealth through the poor. We're not talking about a business deal. And he says that eventually, yes, that's correct. Eventually, somehow, this money is going to get back to the poor, and we want to know exactly how. In other words, we know in general, if a person lives an evil life, it affects the way he thinks, and he'll probably make wrong decisions, either he or his children, and everything he worked for, he's going to lose. But here the Pasuk is directing us that it's saying, no, it's going to go to the poor. The poor are going to get it. So the question is, what does that mean? Rashi says that, see, we're talking about a certain type of evil person that's not destroying society, but he's within society, he operates within society, but he's operating in a harmful way. But when the government hear that he gets rich, they're going to start collecting taxes, and if he does it in an unjust way, they're going to take away more. Like, for instance, the United States, we take away the property of drug runners, and we take it away, and we sell it, and we use it for governmental things. So therefore, the government is going to use this money to build bridges or other things that the public needs. So that way, when the government builds for the public, so the poor will get it. So in that way, the poor gets it. That's what Rashi says. People say, the question is that these people, you know, cheat on taxes, and sometimes they get away with cheating on taxes. It is true. We're talking within the laws of nature. And within the laws of nature, and in a just government, the wealthy are going to pay more taxes. And especially if the guy is evil, they're going to try and bring him down. So in an unjust government, then it's the government that's corrupt. That's not, the verse is not talking about that. The verse is talking about within the just government, that according to Rashi, it's dealing within the just government. So then the money will come to the poor in such a way that they'll have benefits. I mean, it doesn't save them from their poverty, but they will have the benefits of bridges or whatever they're making, whatever they do for the public, then the poor will have it too. In that way, they do get back their money. That's the way Rashi says that. In other words, it's not that they actually get back their money, Rashi says, but in other words, don't think that the wealthy guy is going to keep it. He's not going to keep it, and in a different way, the poor are going to get usage of that money. They're going to get usage of that money, according to Rashi. Some benefits, yes, that's correct. Some benefits. They get some type of benefit. They're not going to get their money back, but they're going to get some type of benefit that started from their money. Ruth is saying in Israel the taxes are like 50%, but however they have, like, for instance, free medical. So therefore the poor definitely get a benefit. So if anybody cheats the poor, I mean, that money is going back to the poor through the government.
Yeah, but
the question is that anybody, Rashi's interpretation, the question is that it's true for any wealthy person, even if he's just, he's going to have to pay higher taxes. But Rashi also says that because that he does it in an unjust way, they're going to take his money away. I think it's closer. Rashi seems to be pointing to the idea what the United States government does is they take away from drug people certain properties that they sell and have usage for it. You see? So it's closer to that idea that they take away the money that they get from the crooks, they put back into the system, and if they put it back into the system, then the poor will have usage out of it. I want to say that this verse that talking about interest can only be talking in a Jewish situation, which we're against interest, and therefore in that situation we would take away that taking on interest is a corrupt thing for us, and therefore we would take away the property of the person that collected on interest. But if it's not in the government where interest is, like the United States, interest is not illegal, So the thing is, there are people that lend money to the poor and they become rich, and the government does not take it away because of that, unless they violate some other laws. But if they don't violate any other laws, then they do have the right to lend with interest, so therefore it would not work. So this verse would only work in a government run under Jewish law.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds correct. We concluded that Rashi must be talking about, the way the verse is talking about interest, is that he's talking about only in a Jewish court or any government where interest is not permitted. Or I would even say, well, only a certain amount of interest is permitted and you charge beyond which is permitted. In other words, let's say they allow you to lend on 5% and you're lending on 10% because the guy can't get it in a legal manner. So in that way, you'll be going against the law, and the law could confiscate your goods, your property, what you get also. So it could also be that type of government too. Okay? But that is Rashi's explanation. Okay? But however, the other commentaries learn that it's a chonein dalem. Chonein dalem is one who helps the poor. He's gathering a person that gathers for the poor. So that type of person that helps and that's kindness for the poor, he will get the money, and therefore he will redistribute it to the poor. Now the question is, and he will get it from the unjust people, okay, from the people that took on interest. They took the money on interest. That's the way the other commentaries learn. But the question is, then the question is, how does it work? I mean, it doesn't seem to happen that way. Well, since we're talking about Mishlei, a person that's chonein dalem, that he has kindness to the poor, there's two types of kindness to the poor. There's a certain person that's kind. He's a nice person and he's kind. And there's a certain person that's kind as a result of the study of Torah. Okay? And if it's a result of the study of Torah, then the person is a chacham. And he's a wise person, and he's a just person. And he tries to, a just person always tries to straighten out, wherever it's in his hands, and the possibility, straighten out an injustice. Okay? So therefore, a person like that recognizes not only enough to help the poor, but also somehow to get the money from the wealthy. In other words, to not just wealthy, but to straighten out the injustice of the person that's taken advantage of the poor. Okay? In other words, like this. There are certain people that won't hurt the poor, harm the poor, but they won't help them. They won't. They're not involved. They just close their eyes. There's certain people that help the poor that they try to give them money, or they try to help them in some way. Then there's certain people that try to straighten out the injustices of society, the people that are taking advantage of the poor. You see? According to them, we're talking about a person that tries to undo injustices in society, that people take advantage of the poor, and they, through their knowledge and understanding, because they have understanding, of the law and using the law and working it out in different ways, they try to take away the money from the wealthy, or to at least get them to stop doing their evil, and then try to get the money to the poor. It's not enough just to get the money to the poor, but to undo the source of the destruction of the poor. In other words, the final destruction of the poor are these people that no poor person cannot protect themselves, and then they go out to take advantage. So there's certain people that try to change that system in the government that is harmful, that they have an opening in the government, or somehow they try through legal means and through the any means possible to try to straighten that out. So the verse is not talking about a person that does not that is not involved. He's not talking about a person that helps the poor, but by giving them money. He's talking about a person that gets involved in the system itself. And the system itself is to help the system, or try to change the system that's harming the poor. That's why the verse, according to them, says to the Chonein Dalam, the one that really is kind and gracious and merciful and really wants to help the poor, that is the best way. They're the ones that work on the injustice that brings it about. We're doing verse 9 now. He who turns his ear from listening to Torah, also his prayer is an abomination. He who turns his ear away from listening to Torah, also his prayers are an abomination. Now the question is that if a person turns away from Torah, why should he pray? The answer is, we're talking about the study of Torah. We're not talking about that he goes against Torah because he's an evil person. He keeps the laws of Torah, but he doesn't study Torah. That's why it says he turns his ear from listening to Torah. Listening to Torah means the study of Torah. He doesn't go to classes, and he doesn't study Torah. Yeah, he keeps the laws and whatever he knows to the best of his ability, and that's it. He's a religious man, and that's it. He keeps the laws to the best of his ability, so his prayers are an abomination to God. Now, the question is, I could understand, okay, it's wrong for not studying Torah, but why is it an abomination? I mean, there's one thing to say that, okay, maybe God won't listen. But why is it an abomination? If the guy's a religious man, why shouldn't God listen? Okay, and why is it an abomination? When you say he keeps the commandments, yeah, but it's, since he doesn't study, he doesn't know precision, he can't keep it precisely. In other words, insofar as halacha, or law, is concerned, he keeps it in a general way. A book like Proverbs that we're studying, I mean, that's out of his realm. You understand? I mean, so he keeps a certain amount of halacha, but and he accepts God, and he turns to God in his prayers. And if he's in trouble, he turns to God. Or he turns to God in his time of need, whatever. And that's an abomination to God. And the question is, what is abomination? I mean, since we don't know anything about God, we can't say God is disgusted. That's what abomination means, disgusted. Can't say, what does it mean practically? I mean, we don't know anything about God. So what does it mean altogether that God, that it's disgusting to God? What does it mean? Okay, Doug wants to say it like this, that the, that when a, it, prayer is a means of relating to God. It's a means of, it's not only getting things from God, but it's a means of relating to God. And you must have knowledge of God. So there's a few things lacking. First of all, if he doesn't study, he doesn't have a knowledge of God himself. And two is, he doesn't have a knowledge of how to relate to God. How to relate to God is, in other words, through prayer, through the study of prayer, that in itself teaches you how to relate to God. You have to study prayer before you could truly pray. You have to have knowledge of God and how God relates to us and how the system works. You don't have that knowledge, you can't make it work for you. So therefore, prayer without learning, you see, is of no value, because it's not doing what prayer is supposed to be doing. Prayer is supposed to benefit you and bring you closer to God. It's an abomination, because when you say the prayers, by definition, you have the wrong view of what it's talking about. Right? Now, the question is, what is abomination? From what I've seen, wherever they use the word abomination throughout I haven't seen it at all, but most of the places that I've seen, abomination means that there's no direct consequence, but there is a consequence. In other words, like this. If smoking leads directly to cancer and emphysema, okay? But if I steal something that's worth a nickel, there's usually no consequences. The problem is, it leads, once I get away with it, after a while, I become secure and I might start doing worse things, and on the worst things I would get caught. So it doesn't, it is not a direct consequence, but there's actions that cause me to do other actions that after a while I get used to doing one set of actions, then I could do another set of actions which is worse than the first, and from the second I will get a consequence. That's what I've seen, abomination, wherever I've seen it. You see? Now the question is that over here, there's no direct consequence. It's just that I just have a wrong view of prayer. It's just not helping me. You see? So the question is, what are the consequences, or what does it lead to when you have this wrong idea? What does it lead to that would lead to destruction? Ruth wants to say like this, that you see, when you pray, you feel a certain amount of security. You feel that the reason why a person prays is because he feels security and he relies on that security to help him. And therefore, he doesn't have to do things like in the laws of nature or other things, and the prayers really don't help. So therefore, he has a full security in what prayers could do for him. Based on that full security, he could do things that would be helpful because he's relying on God to help him, and he doesn't know the truth. He doesn't know when you're supposed to rely on yourself and when you're supposed to rely on God. You must take responsibility for yourself and then rely on God. He might not take the responsibility for himself, and he'll fall in trouble, and he'll rely on God, and it doesn't work. You see? And sometimes Ruth wants to say that sometimes in prayer you feel the prayer is enough, and therefore sometimes if you do something wrong you feel, well, I'm a religious person, so God will overlook it. That could be also. It could be. You're not saying that? In other words, he's not aware that he could do anything wrong since he's a religious person and he relates to God. He can't see that he does anything wrong. Therefore, he could have terrible consequences. When you look at life that way, you could have terrible, terrible consequences. So therefore, if you pray without the true knowledge of prayer, not only is you're not getting anything, but that view of life that you have because the fact that you are praying, so it shows you that you have a view of life that security comes through prayer, and you're faking yourself out with that security, so therefore you'll do things and you'll just get in trouble without realizing why, and then you wonder, why didn't my prayers help? And Ruth wants to also add that sometimes you feel that you're in control through the prayers. You feel that you're in control because of the prayers when you're really not in control, and then also catastrophes could happen. The first thing a person should do is learn halacha on tefillah, where you're obligated to have in mind the exact translations. There's certain places you must think of the translations. There's certain places you don't have to think of the translations, but you have to have the correct idea of the paragraph that you're reading. So that's the first thing, is to get halachically what the minimum is. And then afterwards, then through studying tefillah, studying Tehillim, Psalms, either study the prayers themselves or Psalms, which is where you have commentaries to help you. So there you have, you could gain insight into how tefillah is supposed to work and how tefillah of prayer is supposed to benefit you. So then you could develop above the basic halacha. This week's portion is of the week is Akev, and the weekly portion speaks about all the blessings that the children of Israel will get if they keep the Torah, if they obey God. But there are two places in this week's portion that it talks about the responsibility of Klal Yisrael, of the nation of Israel, to what their responsibility is to get all these blessings that God will give them. Okay? Now, the first one is found in the first verse of the Parsha, of the weekly portion, and that's chapter 7, verse 12. And it says, "And it will be because you will listen to the law, to these laws, and you will guard them, and you will keep them." Then the verse continues of all the blessings that you get, and it goes on and on, many verses of the blessings. Okay? Now Rashi says that it is because you will listen, he says, because the mitzvahs, the commandments, the literal translation is light commandments, understanding that as easy commandments, easy to keep, that a man trashes with his heels, you will listen to. Okay?
Can you repeat that?
The Rashi?
Yeah,
he says the commandments that are easy for man to trash with his heels, you listen to that. That's what it means. If you will listen, so Rashi is saying he has a play on the word, the Hebrew word akev, which is because, and it could be a play on words as heel. So he says if you trash the easy, the simple mitzvahs that are easy, those are the ones, if you listen to those, so then God will give you all the blessings. Okay? Alright. Now, the question is like this. Two questions. First question is, it really doesn't say that in the verse. It just says that when you listen to all the mitzvahs. What's the difference, the light ones, the hard ones, you know what I mean? Any mitzvah, if you don't listen to the commandments, then you won't get the blessings. Why does Rashi force to explain it in this way? What's the plain meaning of the verse is that if you listen to his mitzvahs, God will give you all the blessings. Now, why is he going to this if you trash that which is easy in your eyes, you know what I mean? What is he talking about? I mean, why does he have to mention that? And also another question, that's first of all, how does it fit into the verse? Second question is the statement itself doesn't make any sense. There are people that keep the easy one and trash the hard ones. Like there are people that keep Purim and Hanukkah, and they keep the Seder night, you know, on Passover, but they don't keep the hard ones. They don't keep Shabbos, they don't keep Kashrus. I mean, so what about those? Why don't you say if you don't keep those, you'll also... Yeah, why? What makes one different than the other? You understand? Yeah, it happens to be personal, what is easy for you. But the thing is that why does he mention the easy ones over the hard ones? As long as you don't keep the mitzvahs, what's the difference? Which ones? Why does he specify these? The answer is that the ones that keep the easy ones, okay, not the hard ones, they're definitely not sincere. They just don't want to keep the mitzvahs, so they keep that which is easy to them. They're not sincere, okay? But there's certain people that are really sincere about keeping mitzvahs, okay? I'll give you two examples where two people violated mitzvahs, okay? They're both in the early prophets. One is they were moving the Mishkan, that was the tabernacle, and when they were moving it, it started to fall. And somebody tried to stop it from falling, and he died. Because the law is, you're not allowed to touch the tabernacle, the Mishkan. Okay, you don't have the right to touch it. Now, here's a man that was extremely sincere, you see, but he wasn't listening to the mitzvahs. He's not keeping the mitzvahs. In other words, the Torah is saying, see, there's two types of sincerity. There's a sincerity that I keep the mitzvahs. Oh, let me give you the second example also. Second example is a prophet, a Navi, came over to a man. He says, punch me out. In other words, to give him a wound. The guy says, I can't punch a Navi. And he died on the spot because you must obey the command of a Navi, of a prophet. So here's another sincere person, but because of his sincerity, he violated the Torah. So there's two types of sincerity. There's a sincerity where I really want to keep the mitzvahs, but I decide which is important and which is not. You see? There is another type of sincerity that whatever, I cannot make any decision based on, on what I think a mitzvah should be. I can only make decisions on what God tells me to. I have to think about and understand Torah to understand what God wants from me. So therefore, if I'm going to move the Mishkan or the Tabernacle, I must sit down and learn all the laws of the Mishkan and the Tabernacle so that I should know exactly what to do if there's any type of catastrophe, if I'm allowed to save it or not save it, or other situations. Or if I'm going to, if I was at the time of the prophets and I had to meet with prophets, I should know what my responsibilities, but I cannot make a decision about that. So we're talking about a sincere person. There are many sincere people, but however these sincere people make their own decisions, what is important and what is not important, and to each person it might be different. While the correct sincerity is to only make a decision based only on what the halacha or what the Torah says, how you should live and act out your life. In other words, why the two people of the prophets, the one that tried to stop the tabernacle from falling and the one that couldn't wound the Navi, there are two possibilities why they didn't do it. One, either they were ignorant of the halacha, they didn't know the law. Or two is they knew the law, but emotionally they felt they can't do it. It's not right. How could I wound the Navi? How could I allow the Mishkan to fall? So their emotions made them not listen to the halacha. So therefore, those are the two possibilities of why they failed. The question is a side point: that why would you have to listen to the Navi if he's telling you to cause a wound to him? The answer is because a Navi, a prophet, is speaking for God. So it's just as if God said to you, do this. So I'm obligated to do it, because it's the Navi that's telling him. And the story explains why the Navi needed this particular situation there. But it's a matter of obeying. The Navi is equal. When a Navi speaks, if it's not advice, he's telling you a command, he's telling you what to do, so then it's equal to God telling you what to do. It's like a halacha. It's a private halacha for you, that this is your private halacha, that you have to wound the Navi, that you have to wound the prophet. So it's a private halacha, personal halacha for a particular time, and not for the future, just for now. But it's God. It's like God speaking to you. Now, the second place in this week's portion, it's chapter 8, verse 1. The second place where it talks about the responsibility of Israel to get all these blessings, it says, all the mitzvos that I command you today, you should keep to do. And then it says that then you'll inherit the land, and then it says all the blessings. Okay? Now Rashi says, well, first of all, you could accept it as the simple explanation, but he mentions the Medrash. And the Medrash says like this: if you begin a commandment, you should complete it, because a commandment is named on the one that completes it. And he brings a proof, because in Joshua it says that the bones of Yosef that Israel brought up from Egypt, they buried in Shechem. That was a city. Now Rashi asked the question, but however, Moshe alone was involved with them to bring them up. Okay, and he brings a proof from Shemos in some place in Exodus. He brings a proof that Moshe himself was involved with it and not Israel. But so Rashi answers, Ella, but because there wasn't sufficient time for him to complete it because he died, so Israel completed it. So it's named, it's called after their name. In other words, that's why in Joshua it says that the children, the bones of Yosef that the children of Israel brought up. That's why it says there, because they completed the mission by burying it in thereby burying it in Shechem. Okay, but the reason why Moshe couldn't do it is because he died; he never got into Israel. Okay, so that's the Rashi. The first question that we have to ask is that's a very nice explanation that Rashi is saying, but again, what does it have to do with the verse? It doesn't explain the verse. The verse simply says, you should keep all the mitzvahs that I command you. And suddenly he goes into this whole thing about who completes it. The second thing is, Rashi says that if you begin one, you should complete it. So Rashi should give an example where a person started and he decided not to complete it. Instead, Rashi gives us an example that somebody else started it. One person started, namely Moshe. He didn't complete it. So the other, it's named after the last person. And the last question is that why Moshe did all the work. He really did the hardest part. And they just finished it. And why should it be in their name? Okay? Hey, the thing is that there's two parts to the mitzvah. One part of the mitzvah is that you did an act. You did an act that you were responsible to do. You're obligated to do acts, just acts. Completion of the act is not always in your hands, but it's a group responsibility. Okay? So what Rashi is saying is that there's two things. One is, insofar as your reward and punishment is if you do correct acts or incorrect acts. Okay? But however, insofar as the system is concerned, there is a group effort that you can only keep the system only as a group. Like, for instance, it says you should keep all the mitzvahs. Right, that's what the verse said. All the mitzvahs that I commanded you, you should guard to do. Okay? So the thing is, I can't do all the mitzvahs because I'm not a Kohen. I'm not a priest. So I can't do the job of the Kohen. And also, there's the mitzvah, it is one of the 613 that you should return the stolen goods. Well, let's say I never stole. So I can't fulfill that part of the Torah. You see? So there's different parts of the Torah that I can't complete, but as a unit, we have to complete it. So the completion shows in other words, the act attaches to you personally what you did correctly. But the completion of the system is not in your hands totally, it's part of the system. It attaches to the system. The object of all the mitzvahs. The object of all the mitzvahs is that the system should work correctly. It's the system, and you're just part and parcel of that system. What Rashi says is that you should complete it, in other words, because there's two things. There's doing the mitzvah, and then recognizing the system that you're doing it for. That you recognize that I'm only part of the system. I can never accomplish the system. And the purpose is to keep the system. And to keep the system, I need the nation of Israel. I can't do it on my own. All the mitzvahs. Kol ha-mitzvah. All the mitzvahs. If you keep all the mitzvahs as a nation. Okay, it's not each individual mitzvah. That's why when Rashi asked the question that Moshe did it all his own, Moshe did it all his own insofar as Moshe's perfection, his personal perfection is all, that is perfected, and he will have a portion in the world to come accordingly. Okay, but insofar as that's why Rashi used two different people to show that the most important thing is that you're part of this system of Israel. Well, it says who completes it. It doesn't say the person that completes it gets credit. It says it's named after him. It's named that he did the final thing to bring conclusion to the system. It closes the system. There's no break in the system. Moshe only did it part way. The system wouldn't have been completed. He might have did the correct act and he'll be rewarded for it, but the system is not completed. The system has to be completed through some other people. So they get the credit for completing the system, but not the reward. The reward is what they did, they buried the bones. So whatever reward there is in that, but it's not the way you take on the total responsibility, what Moshe did, which was greater. You understand, insofar as responsibility is concerned. But insofar as system is concerned, the one that completes the activity, that's the one that gets it. That's the one that it's named, not reward. An example of this, another example of this is in the Psalms, Psalm 122, verse 1. It says, Shir Malos, it says to David, and David says like this, I am happy when people said to me that we will go to the house of God, meaning the Beis HaMikdash. So Rashi is bothered with the question, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, was built by King Solomon, and it wasn't built at the time of King David. So how could he be happy that they're saying, I'm going up to the house of God? It wasn't built yet. You understand? So how could he hear that? So Rashi explains, listen to this Rashi. He says, I heard people saying, when is that old man meaning Kid David, will die? And his son Shlomo, or Solomon, will reign. And he will build the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, and we will go up for the holidays. And then it says, in the pasuk, it says, Samachti, I was happy, so Rashi ends off, and I am happy. I'm happy that they said this. King David says, I'm happy that they said this. That's a little crazy. Somebody wishes you die, and you say, I'm happy they said that. I could understand, okay, the guy's crazy, you overlook it. But I'm happy. What is he happy about? He's happy that the system that they're involved, that these people are involved in the system, and they want to get the final step in the system, which is the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, God took us out of Egypt. He gave us the Torah, and the final thing, he brought us into the land. The final thing, which didn't happen yet, was the Beis HaMikdash. So even though I don't know what motivated them. And I don't know if they're right in saying such a thing. That I don't know. But from David's perspective, he was relating, he was happy that the system was working. You see what I mean? I would like to just summarize the two places in our weekly portion of the two places. And that is that insofar as relating to halacha, it brings about two types of humility. The first type of humility is a recognition that I must recognize that I am part and parcel of the system and I cannot decide what is in the system. You see, I don't have the right to decide. I could spend my life involved in the world of study and ideas, but I don't create anything new. What I do is just try to understand what God wants from me. That's all. I recognize that I must live according to the system. The second thing, I recognize that I'm part and parcel of this nation called Israel. I can't separate myself that I'm smarter, I'm better. I'm part of the nation, and I cannot separate from that and think of myself as something special, but I'm only a cog in the wheel, and I have to do correct actions, even though the actions are not completed, and the ultimate goal is the system, and I cannot do it. I have to rely on people after me to do it. You see? So that's the two types of humility in keeping the system. The question is, what would be an example today of this idea? Okay? The example is that if somebody is sick, and he needs somebody to help him, and you're involved in the world of learning, so then it depends. There's somebody else there, so then you should not quit learning. If nobody else is there, so then you have to do it. So in other words, you see that the system must, this person needs help, and he must get help. whether I should do it or somebody else should do it, that's dependent on halacha. Who should do it is dependent on halacha. Many times you feel, well, I should do it. I mean, how can I let a guy just lie there? Right. So therefore, whether I should help the person depends. If there are other people to help them, so then I should continue my life of study. If there's nobody else to help them, then I have no choice. I must do the act. So you see that you can't make a decision on your personal thing, and you see that you could rely on others. You see both ideas in this very example, in this this example in everyday life. Now the question is, how would this relate to a Noachite? Okay? The thing is that a Noachite would relate to God via the God's system of the universe. He's not included in the... He could see God's wisdom in Torah, but since he's not included in Torah, he could relate. His humility is by studying, in other words, is by studying God's creations and relating to God through God's creations. In other words, there's many ways of relating to God, and there's many ways of having humility. By humility is to recognize that I'm just a cog in the wheel of God's will, you see? So therefore, these verses are only talking to Klal Yisrael, that to the nation of Israel. But even the nation of Israel and the Noahite, any human being, could study the universe and recognize that he's only part of a system. He could study justice, ideas of justice, and recognize that he's just part of a social fabric, and he has to understand what his responsibility to the social fabric is. And he could recognize God in when he sees all these systems. He recognizes God, and he recognizes that he must be a part of God's, that he is a part of God's system. And when he acts, even as a Noahite, that he's operating part, which is also part and parcel of God's system. In other words, there are many ways of seeing God from many different angles. And each person, according to how where they are in life, that's the way they could find their way of relating to God.